From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the 5th day of June, 2020. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzlo. He's at globalanalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas. And then we'll take a much closer look at gasoline usage in the United States. We'll hear a portion of our Commodity Week program with Patrick DeHaan as our special guest. He's an analyst for GasBuddy.com. That's the app you may very well use to find the lowest gas prices in your neighborhood. And we'll do all of that on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, here are the numbers as they finished up in Chicago. July corn up 2 1/4, 331 and a quarter the settlement price. December 345 and a quarter, 2 1/2 higher. July beans unchanged at 867 and 3/4. November at 879 and a half, up 2 3/4. The bean oil 32 cents higher. Bean meal down 70 cents. And soft red winter wheat 8 1/2 lower at 515 and a quarter in the July contract. Live cattle were down 182 and a half. The feeders off 55 cents, and lean hogs were down 97 and a half cents. We're down joined by Mike Zuzlo at globalanalytics.biz out of Atchison, Kansas, to take a look at what happened in the marketplace. Hey, good afternoon to you, Michael.
Great to be with you, Todd.
All right, so let's start in the wheat. We had a good day yesterday, but things have turned around today. Why?
I think mostly technicals and just a reversal at the end of the week, because we are in those harvest Fridays now when it comes to the hard red wheat. And I think we also saw a little bit more in the GFS noonday model of potential rainfall coming for some of the areas of the wheat belt that maybe could take on more water and add to the ability of the yield potential in what has been a very, very hot week out here, with heat indices well over 100 and actual temperatures in places like Hutchinson, Kansas, running 3 to 5 days in a row. It's expected now to be over 100 degrees. So the big thing we saw yesterday, you brought that up, Todd, I'm glad you did, because what we saw yesterday was a hard red wheat hit its 50-week moving average, and it closed right on it. And so we needed a good, strong follow-through day. But when we saw the short covering come in on the dollar, I think that probably nixed the ability of the technicals to carry this market on higher. And we did see the dollar strengthen, the ruble weaken, so on and so forth. So wheat didn't provide us the necessary support that it did earlier this week. And you can see how the beans kind of stalled out. Beans were really running nicely and making, you know, multi-week highs in the November futures here with the help of the wheat. So that's something to keep in mind next week as we go into Thursday's crop report. Is does wheat help or hurt the row crops, given everything that USDA threw on top of us on world wheat ending stocks last month? I guess it was
the S&P 500, the Dow, and the dollar are all up pretty good today. The Dow up, what, almost 900 points. The S&P up around 80 to 90 points for the afternoon. Does this tell you anything about the macroeconomics at all?
Yeah, because if you throw on top of that a 6% rally in the unleaded and the crude oil market, and then a pretty big correction in the gold market, you're seeing some money movement here. If you take a weekly or monthly look at this market right now, notice that the dollar was able to drop back to, I believe it was an 8 or 9 week low, and that put us back to levels not seen since before COVID. We were back in the trading range for the U.S. dollar index that we were in before the COVID broke. And I think between that and the stock market, and then the gold leading us higher to getting within, I think, $150 an ounce of its 2011 highs, you see the market is getting inflationary. The market is essentially signaling the all clear economically. And I think when you saw the unemployment numbers of 13% today, 13.3% today, that was a real boon for the risk on trade and the stock market in particular, because traders were thinking 19% was going to be the unemployment number. The other thing that really helps the commodities going into next week's report, in my opinion, is the fact that OPEC Plus decided to go ahead and continue that 9.7 million barrel a day production cut all the way through the end of July. So that really sets the stage for continued supply drawdowns in unleaded and in ethanol, as long as we don't have a resurgence of COVID and we continue on the path of opening the economy back up. Obviously, watching the riots at this point in these major cities and seeing what that may do to consumption and may do to holiday travel as well.
So if inflation is coming in and the market is higher, do you have hopes that a low has been at least a near-term put in for corn and soybeans?
I think it goes back to what we've talked about ever since the early part of March and the Beef House meeting, and that is the U.S.-China trade negotiations, Todd. If we can keep on a nicer playing field with them between now and the election, which I have my doubts about that. We've talked about that. But if we can play nice together with the kind of weather we're starting to see with this Cristobal tropical depression or tropical storm system coming in and maybe waylaying an already very saturated Illinois and Indiana and Missouri corn and bean crop. And then you throw on top of it the new news about the dicamba ruling with the courts. You've got a lot of things starting to go in the positive direction. But I think when I say that, I think of how many times I've said that right before a major USDA report, and then it's like a house of cards after that report comes out. So I'll feel a lot better about saying these things after Thursday's close of next week.
On that dicamba note, it takes sunshine to grow a crop, and without dicamba on these millions of acres of soybeans, there will be a lot of weeds, and a really big yield hit is quite likely to take place. We'll see how that plays out in the marketplace over time. Anything else you want to talk about today?
I think the biggest thing to watch here as we get to the crop report is we noticed very succinctly that the soybeans did pick up Chinese demand, but it picked up Chinese demand in new crop. We're still running 9% behind last year in the 19-20 marketing year, and we crossed 39 weeks this week. So this is not, I don't think, a demand-led market in the soybeans. I think it's all these other things that we've talked about. So beans really do need the wheat. They really do need the dollar, the Brazilian real, a big, big deal this week. So that's what we need to continue as we go into next week's trade.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd. Have a great weekend.
You too. Mike Zuzulo is with GlobalAnalytics.biz. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're now joined by Eric Snodgrass from Nutrient Ag Solutions and Agrible. Hey, good afternoon to you, Eric. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You know, I saw on Twitter, and I was thinking about this. I think this is right, that they really like the idea that there were a whole bunch of clouds around, and it has been a cloudy spring so far, and the reason they were mentioning it was because the sunsets are so dang beautiful, but I'm wondering if that has any other impact.
Yeah, you know, I mapped this out earlier this week and also threw it up on Twitter too, because I found it quite interesting that much of the central and western Corn Belt, so basically from Illinois clear over to South Dakota and then down to Nebraska, and of course that includes Iowa, we had a very cloudy May. In fact, one of the cloudiest on record coming out of parts of eastern Nebraska and southeastern South Dakota. And with that, you know, this crop has not been able to get too much heat on it, even though it's been warm as of late. And without the strong sunshine, it's really not shot up like I think we would have expected it to. So that's been a major factor driving our spring weather. Some locally heavy rains and then also this, you know, abundance of clouds.
Any pattern change that'll take those away?
Well, you know, that's part of the bigger issue we're trying to decide right now, because the pattern is changing. And I'll tell you, recently, the pattern we've been in has given us some locally extremely heavy rainfall amounts. In fact, right here around central Illinois, we had some spots that were completely missed. Can you believe it? By those thunderstorms the other day, and some places that got up to 6 inches of rainfall in a 24-hour time period. Well, the pattern change that's happening is going to be west first. So after having about 8 days of triple-digit heat in the Central Valley of California, they're going to be seeing temperatures drop off into the 70s. And as that heat migrates across the central plains of the United States, and it's going to get us, we're still got about 5 more days or so of these above-average temperatures. Well, middle of the week next week, cold front sweeps through, cools us off for, a lot of the middle part of the month of June here. So the heat that's on now, it doesn't continue, which honestly is a good thing. We don't want it to just get stuck and never go away. So, yep, we do have a pattern break coming here once we get in the middle of next week.
How, if at all, does Cristobal fit into that puzzle?
Well, it fits nicely into the puzzle. The front that's going to sweep through middle of next week is actually going to grab what is left of Cristobal and take it right on through Illinois and then over to the Eastern Corn Belt. So Cristobal right now is back to tropical depression status, and that's simply because it just hasn't left the Yucatan Peninsula. But once it gets back into the Gulf of Mexico over the beginning of this weekend, it will certainly strengthen. It's going to hit Louisiana probably as a stronger tropical storm, so probably not at this point. No one's forecasting it to hit hurricane strength, but it doesn't matter. It's going to be bringing in 3 to 5 inches of rainfall with local amounts getting as high as 10 inches right there along the Gulf Coast. Comes right through the Delta, goes through Arkansas, Missouri, and then into Illinois. So we could expect midweek next week some pretty locally heavy rains from this again, which is going to continue what's already been a very wet spring, although it's still pales in comparison to 2019 in most locations.
We're not very far from the official start of summer on the 21st day of this month. Have there been any new model runs that give us an indication of what it will look like?
Yeah, well, it's good that that this particular Friday lines up with the timing when we get the brand new long range updates from the European model. So they just came out. And honestly, the model right now for us has got us on a kind of a hot and wet summer. It's not right now showing me any indications of extreme heat, but it's keeping the temperatures up, but it's keeping the moisture going. And so if we continue to have kind of a hot and wet summer, the concerns I have, of course, are going to be issues with, you know, fungal pressures and things like that. And then, of course, having some ponding in some fields if we continue on this wet pattern. You know, I'm talking July into August. But also, what does that mean in terms of overnight temperatures, and how could that possibly impact, you know, the health of the crop and eventually what its total yield is going to be? So hot and wet is certainly better than me saying hot and dry, but, you know, each year presents its own weather challenges, and that's what we're looking at right now for the rest of the summer.
Any opportunity for regional droughts? I saw, you know, a flicker of drought that was coming out of the West at one point earlier in the year.
Yes and no. Some of that's been squashed recently by some very heavy rainfall. So we've kind of beat back the drought that was expanding out of the four corner states and didn't let it really get across the Central Plains as we moved into June, which is good. We don't want to see that. But with any summer pattern, what I get to worry about now is the flash drought situations where all of a sudden we get a series of days that are hot and dry and we just drain the moisture out of the top 4 inches of the soil there. And it becomes an issue that if we don't have that moisture in place, that we could start to see some problems. So that's what I'm most concerned about for this summer is regional flash drought and some short duration heat. So yes, I think we all need to be watching that. And I'm going to tell you something, the drought monitor it's not even designed to capture that. That's something that happens not on the timescales that the drought monitor is designed to measure.
Turn your attention elsewhere on the planet. An update from the Black Sea area, please.
Yeah, so Black Sea area had the same problem that much of the Corn Belt had this May, which was it was cool at times and very cloudy. So they also have had kind of a slow start to the season. Now, the difference there is the next 2 weeks is looking to go over hot and dry. And given the fact that they did not go into their spring with an abundant amount of surface and then subsurface soil moisture, many of us are starting to worry about the potential for more widespread drought to develop, especially in places like Ukraine. So we've got to keep our eye there because there could be some issues with supply of grain coming out of the Black Sea region.
Hey, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
You have a great weekend. That, of course, is Eric Snodgrass. He is with Nutrien Ag Solutions.
Support for WILL comes from the Illinois Sustainable Ag Partnership, sponsor of the 3-part risk management webinar series on June 18th, 25th, and July 2nd. Notable keynote speakers will be featured. More details at ilsustainableag.org.
Yesterday afternoon, we recorded our Commodity Week program with our panelist, Merrill Crowley, from First Choice Commodities, Chip Nellinger of Blue Reef Agri-Marketing, and Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting, along with our special guest, Patrick DeHaan of GasBuddy.com out of Chicago, where he serves as the head of petroleum analysis. I started by asking Patrick to tell me a little bit about GasBuddy and his title.
Well, GasBuddy is a price tracking website where motorists can find the lowest prices in their community all across the U.S. and in Canada as well. Being the head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy, what I do is basically break down oil and gasoline prices to help educate them on where prices may go, the trends and further analysis on basically kind of a value addition to our app that we have.
Well, a couple of quick questions that I have. I believe that OPEC met again this week. Did they come to any decisions?
Well, OPEC was mulling over meeting and when they were going to meet in early June. They tend to have a meeting in early June, but there was amongst it some disagreement on exactly what they were going to be doing at that meeting. So there is some discontent, again, wrangling with OPEC and Russia. I think this is really an OPEC issue and Russia issue, Saudi Arabia and Russia being the two that are kind of going at each other here. And Saudi Arabia, certainly a little bit more susceptible to the current low price of oil, which sits at about $37 a barrel today, whereas the Russians can survive on lower oil prices and may not want to curb production for an extended amount of time like the Saudis may to boost the price of oil back up closer to where their economy would need it to be.
I thought it was the other way around. Can you explain to me what the analysis is there that lets the Russians be the lowest cost producer?
Well, at least at this point, it's all based on budgetary spending in each of those countries. Saudi Arabia's prime source of revenue is oil. And so more of their budget is reliant on whatever the price of oil may be. The Russian economy is a little bit more diverse than the price of oil, though oil still makes up a big part of it. And so they're a little bit more insulated to the lower price of oil. And that's where you see disagreement is. As Saudi Arabia has seen increases in the last 10, 20 years in the price of oil, their budget has gone up. And so now they're at a point where they are more reliant on that oil revenue. And as a result, that spending then really requires them or basically outlines that they need to sell oil for upwards of $60 a barrel to be able to have that spending. Whereas Russia does not necessarily need as high of a price for oil for their budget to be non-impacted.
Just as the United States was going into the COVID-19 or coronavirus pandemic, the Russians and the Saudis agreed, relatively speaking, to open the spigot up. And the lack of demand because cars weren't moving in the United States because of the pandemic and the increase in oil and influx pushed the price of oil into the $20 a barrel level. It's of course, rebounded since then, as you said. Can you tell me about the demand and usage over that period and what you think will happen in the summertime? And this is directly related from our perspective in agriculture to the use of corn, as it is a 10% blend in all gasoline across the United States that is sold, or most of it, that is.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you mentioned, gasoline demand has certainly struggled amidst the pressure of shelter-in-place orders that at one point had affected a bulk over 80% of U.S. states. Gasoline demand fell from its winter low, which typically is somewhere in the upper 8, low 9 million barrel per day range, all the way down to under 6 million barrels a day. In fact, there's possible that the first week in April, in which GasBuddy data points out was the weakest of the weeks, that gasoline demand slipped under 5 million barrels. So basically half of what we see during the summer is what we saw during coronavirus. And so that certainly had far-reaching impacts on the price of oil, oil-producing countries. And like you mentioned, the price of ethanol as well. Not only the price of ethanol had struggled due to Trump's feud with China, basically undermining the price of corn, but then the fact that as a result of lower gasoline demand, there was less ethanol being blended in the price of gasoline. So we certainly saw a very rare instance during the height of the coronavirus situation in which the price of gasoline, which is nearly always above the price of ethanol, actually traded under the price of ethanol.
Dan Zwicker at Zwicker Consulting, do you have a question for Patrick DeHaan?
Well, one question I have is I spend the winters down in the tip of Texas right along the Mexican border, and I was watching gas prices during the pandemic, or the height of it anyway, And I always noticed that Wisconsin was posting the cheapest price of gasoline. I don't know if it was a misprint or was there something that caused that. They were significantly cheaper than any other state.
Yeah, it was a fairly impressive period of weeks in March in which gas prices in all 50 states were declining. But as you mentioned, Wisconsin, which is not typically amongst the lowest priced states in the country, quickly fell to the lowest average by far, by some 20 cents a gallon. It was in first place with the lowest average. And there's not necessarily a whole lot of rhyme or reason why that may have happened. Clearly, Wisconsin became somewhat of a battleground for retailers to lower prices, but it may have something to do with the fact that Wisconsin, unlike most states, has a unfair sales act, or what's better known as a price floor on retail margins. That is, gas stations cannot sell gasoline at a loss. And knowing that their price basically included a markup, stations may have been quicker to pass along the discounts, knowing that they would still be protected if they lower prices quicker. Certainly a very interesting situation. And since then, of course, Wisconsin is now kind of back normal in where it normally is, slightly under the national average. But certainly there was aggressive competition in Wisconsin, and I surmise much of it had to do with the fact that retailers were essentially guaranteed a margin, which is not the case in many states. And during this pandemic, stations have been very slow to lower prices simply because they're dealing with in some cases, 50 to 70% decline in gasoline demand, and they're being very cautious, or they were very cautious about lowering prices too quickly.
Merrill Crowley from First Choice Commodities, do you have a question?
Back in May of 2020, you had an interview, and you said the wild card that people weren't considering was looking at the refineries that process oil, and that they need to get back into the game as demand starts to back up. The key to that was refinery utilization. How do you see that progressing, and your thoughts maybe through the rest of the year?
It's been very interesting to see what has developed over the last month and a half, certainly out of left field, I would say, since some of those comments. We have been dealing with a environment where refineries have seen a slight uptick in refinery utilization, responding to the increase in demand that we've started to see. Gasoline demand still somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 25% below year-ago levels, but it has risen, notably, in some cases, 30% off lows. Now, the increase in utilization has been less than 5 percentage points, meaning that refineries are scaling up. But the interesting dynamic here is that due to the slowdown in the broader economy, diesel, which is a heavy oil more utilized by commerce, farmers, agriculture, and indeed school buses, which haven't been running for the better part of 3 months, have been sitting idle. And that has essentially destroyed a significant amount of diesel demand. So prior to coronavirus, heavier oils were actually fetching more of a margin than gasoline was. And so refineries were tilting in the favor of producing more of those heavy oils, including distillate. But now with demand for distillate having plummeted, refineries may not need to increase utilization rates. They may instead skew their runs to process more light crude oil, which would then yield more gasoline and less distillate at the same percentage rates that they're currently running.
Chip Nellinger from Blue Reef Agri Marketing.
Yeah, I was just wondering. Obviously, there's been a rapid decrease in the demand with the shelter in place across the country and mostly across the world. We have massive supplies of crude oil, offshore in tankers at the Gulf. How do you see that balance that we've low prices have shut production down, but yet we have this massive supply. Tanks are full and offshore. How do you see that battle taking place, and what kind of a range would you expect in crude oil going forward?
Well, as you mentioned, there have been dozens of VLCCs, very large crude carriers, parked along the U.S. coast. Well documented that we had millions of barrels of Saudi crude oil several weeks ago sitting off the coast of California. But as WTI, West Texas Intermediate crude oil, and Brent crude oil, as oil prices have found support in recent weeks on the heels of gasoline demand that's recovered, some of those tankers have been offloaded. We saw U.S. imports surge in the last 2 weeks, according to the Energy Information Administration, which is the department under the Department of Energy. And so we have started to see some of those imports land in the U.S. And I would expect that as oil prices continue to hold near $37, $38 a barrel in the 30s, that we may see more of that oil that's sitting offshore come into port and enter the U.S. inventory system. And as you mentioned, U.S. oil production numbers have certainly plunged from 13 million barrels ahead of coronavirus now to closer to 11 million barrels. And with the economy still struggling, they may not, those U.S. production numbers may not recover as quickly as we may see some global production recover. So it's in the months ahead, it's really going to be contingent on whether or not gasoline demand can continue to drive the economy, whether it will pull up distillate demand, whether low gas prices will pull the economy up, or whether the overall weight of a slowdown in the economy would pull gasoline demand down. We're clearly looking at 40 million Americans that are out of work now. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic to see which way the economy goes. But I could see crude oil prices, if there are no second waves, I think we're a little bit overvalued at $37. But I think we shouldn't slip beneath, say, $25 to $26 a barrel, barring any major shifts in where we are right now as a result of coronavirus.
I'd like to take up some political issues, if you dare, that is, as it's related to ethanol. I'm wondering whether you have an idea how much ethanol really needs to be in a gallon of gasoline for the octane rating to maintain a level at 87, 89, 93, whatever it happens to be, and how much of that 10% blend the oil industry would like to recapture if it can.
Well, I think almost guaranteed, unless you're Valero, which is a company that has a significant amount of ethanol production, I would think that most of the oil industry, given their stance, would probably want to claw a lot of that back. We have seen them applying for SREs, refinery exemptions, small refinery exemptions, to try and dodge those RFS requirements that require them to blend ethanol into gasoline. Having said that, in the last 5 years, we've been in somewhat of a shortage of alkylate, which is a blending component to gasoline that pulls the octane rating higher. In addition, on the last decade, manufacturers have been moving towards vehicles that meet CAFE standards. Well, prior to President Trump dismantling some of those, manufacturers had been utilizing higher octane to get higher fuel efficiency in some cases. And so that led to that, and the low quality of crude oil in some U.S. Regions was causing alkylate inventories to suffer. And the price of premium was trading, and in many places at the retail level, is still $1 per gallon more than regular gasoline. As it turns out, of course, ethanol's octane rating is somewhere in the neighborhood of 95 to 100 AKI, which is significantly higher than gasoline. And if manufacturers had the grounds for it, instead of utilizing premium with alkylate at a much higher cost, I think manufacturers could move towards a premium fuel that would be, say, E30 or E35. Unfortunately, we're not there yet. There's a lot of red tape that has held that back. Of course, just last year, the ethanol industry and agriculture was able to convince the administration to approve E15 year-round, and that's new. But it'll be interesting to see if in the years ahead, the relatively low cost of corn and its high octane level could act as a substitute to alkylate, which has been pretty pricey.
That's Patrick DeHaan with GasBuddy.com. You can hear the rest of his comments on our Commodity Week program. Many of these radio stations will carry it over the weekend, or you can find it online right now at willag.org. That's willag.org. Just click and play right out of the website. or if you'd prefer to look for it and listen to it in one of your favorite podcast applications, you can do that too by using SoundCloud, Stitcher, NPR One, Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast. However you'd like to listen to us, thanks so much for taking your time and spending it with us here at Illinois Public Media. And again, find us online at willag.org. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.